Okay. Let's see. I think we should be live at this time. If
Cool.
anybody can hear us in the comments, let us know. I'm here with Volar Records. Let's see. This should update the number of viewers in just 1 second. Sometimes it's a little laggy. Okay, cool. It looks like we're starting off with 40 people. If anybody can hear me in the chat, please let me know. And then we will cut to the chase because we have quite a bit to talk about today, quite a bit of really interesting stuff. Okay, cool. All right, what's up, Seabritton? I see you. So, guys, I'm here with Volar Records. A lot of you probably have heard of some of his work. I wanted to kind of link up and speak to him today. Let me just pull up what he's been working on a little bit so we can kind of get a little bit of baseline for what we're going to talk about. So Volar Records recently, I would say, when did you start this? About August?
About 3 weeks ago.
Okay, he has put out an 8-part series now at this point that covers the relationship between UAP legacy programs, the Bush Channel, or the Bush family, the 1933 Magenta case, Dick Cheney, companies like EG&G and the Carlyle Group, including a part 8 that just recently came out. I haven't got a chance to read that yet, so we'll talk about that today. But the amount of research here and the quality of the posting is just so fantastic. I know he's worked closely with a lot of other people I've talked to, such as Seabritton in the chat, 36, 39, 42, Max Parr, Kermit, all fantastic researchers. So, Volar, if you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit and kind of tell us a little bit how you got into investigating the phenomenon, and then how you said that all the talk of Dick Cheney being at the top of the UFO pyramid inspired you. I'd like to hear how you got into this subject and this specific research project.
Sure. Like a lot of folks been into this stuff since I was a kid, kind of terrified and fascinated at the same time. Was buying books. I just turned 44, so I was of an age where, it was like right when, Unsolved Mysteries and Sightings and all the shows were coming out and growing up an 80s kid. And I was buying books. I had a little section on my bookshelf of like UFO cases and stuff. I never really lost interest, but it kind of came and went, in terms of intensity. And we were talking right before we went live. I think in 2004 there was the famous case of the Mexican pilots. I'm pretty sure it was Mexico. And it's like the seven lights craft, whatever, that they see. And that was a pretty big deal. And I think that was about the time that YouTube hit. And so that went pretty viral, and to the point that, it was like Mexico and Venezuela and a few other Central and South American countries. And I know it was Sweden and I don't remember who else, but, there was an attempt at building this kind of international coalition for transparency, and of course the United States didn't want to have anything to do with it. And then, yeah, I mean, cut to 2017. We all know what happened there. It was such a huge thing. And then in 2020, with really nothing to do, I was pretty involved with the protests and stuff. And I think once a lot of that started quieting down, in the fall, I was just all in on this because everything else was so messed up. It was just kind of like, okay, like we're in a pretty bad spot, kind of all around. And so yeah, just a lot of my free time was spent, watching stuff and listening to podcasts and just kind of soaking things in. And we'll talk more about this, but I think a lot of this has been about, normalizing a lot of this stuff,
Yeah, I know we were talking about it a little bit, and it's something that's featured heavily in your research, is kind of calling back to statements Grush has made, whether on his News Nation appearance, whether his congressional hearings. And it sounds like Grush was like a massive influence for a lot of your work. And would you say that, especially in July of 2023, with Grush on News Nation, the Senate hearings, that kind of kickstarted you to research this in depth into a subject?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I was already there, but definitely, I mean, that changed everything,
Right.
That was such a huge deal. I mean, Elizondo was a big enough deal. But yeah, Grush, I mean, Grush spun me out. You know, I remember I had a whole, the whole next day, I was just like in a weird haze almost, you know? And it was, you know, it was funny because I kept thinking things were going to change right away, you know, and we're still here. Yeah, I mean, a lot's happened, but, you know, I think so much of this has been about learning, you know, kind of the way Matthew Pines has been talking about it, you know, this sort of word of mouth desensitization and normalization. And, you know, you can still kind of go about your day. And, you know, I think because of the fluid nature of media now and the way that we consume it, you can very easily see some crazy UFO video and then keep scrolling Twitter or whatever. You know what I mean? And you're just like, oh, okay, that's pretty nuts. And then kind of move on, you know, to a degree. But yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure. I'll say it was around, we were talking about this, but you know, before we started recording, but I think it was around December that Ross Coulthart did a talk at a library in Victoria in Australia. And at the very end, he mentioned EGNG, and I think it was JT4 and some other stuff. And I think that was when I got past the cool video part. Mm-hmm. And started actually digging into like, oh, we're talking about, you know, companies and organizations and agencies and this stuff, you know, this is a lot bigger. And I know there were people there before me, you know, it's funny now going back, looking through Reddit and stuff, doing research where it's like, oh, people were there even before Grush, you know, they'd already been digging in. But for me, it was kind of moving past some of the shock, I guess, you know, and getting to a point where it's like, yeah, this is more than real. It's like, there's just the history of this is a lot bigger than I think any of us had realized.
Yeah. And that's something I really appreciate about kind of your work and the eight parts we're going to talk about. Videos to me, at least, mean very little. And I'm super vocal about this. Almost every video I do, it's kind of the hard-nosed paper trail, the official documents, the alleged involvement of certain contractors and three-letter organizations. That's kind of the research avenues I like to go down to actually kind of move a conversation forward instead of just going in circles about some lights in the sky footage and so forth.
Right. So, because there's not that much to do with that necessarily.
No, like no.
But that's what they're right. We're all here, you know, to a degree. But
so I'd love to just kind of dive into part one here, because part one of your eight-part series really starts to focus on the introduction of the Bush family and their involvement with the creation of the OSS, Alan Dulles, and the 1933 Magenta Italy crash retrieval case, something I've covered a lot before. So I'd love to just kind of hear some summarization and points of that post. If you'd like to share your screen as well to kind of go through research, we can do that. Otherwise, I can show some stuff, because I think especially the base point here, part one, is super consequential, especially with the implication of the Brown brothers and Harriman and so forth that I learned from your work.
Oh, really? Yeah. I, having been so active on Reddit a few months ago, I think it was 36, 39, 42, started a little private chat with a few of us. And that's when we started kind of bouncing things off of each other, you know, because really it was just them and Harry's wife timeline.
Right.
Like I think in terms of narrative and a literal, you know, editing timeline, like let's start looking at it like that. And it'll make it easier to piece this stuff together. So yeah, eventually, I mean, it really was just the last 2 or 3 months maybe that, you know, a lot of that, it was like I was seeing Bush's name pop up in a lot of the earlier research. And then, you know, we kind of would all keep digging in different time periods. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just started coming together more, you know, and the Brown Brothers Harriman stuff. I think we were kind of on that. And then it was really just a few weeks ago, you know, I've been watching a lot of the Sheehan interviews, and he had mentioned Bush a few times, and there's the story of, you know, him or Carter, you know, bringing him in to brief him and Bush saying no. And then one of the last interviews he did, 2 weeks ago, maybe it was right before I started posting this. He pretty much spent his entire hour only talking about Bush.
Yeah, that was the October 18th Your Right to Know interview. I believe so. It's one of his most recent ones.
Maybe it was with, was that the one with Jeffrey Mishlove?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
And that's where he really starts to dive into Bush. I think H.W. Bush as well was mentioned by Lou Elizondo as kind of having some sort of knowledge of UFO crash retrieval programs or just an estimate of the UAP situation.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember if I saw that. Yeah. But yeah, just kind of this whole thing is so crazy. You know, I think a lot of these posts, I was just banging them out basically late at night. You know, I just stay up for, you know, 6 or 7 hours and just like, I feel so weird walking around with this stuff. You know, I have to get it out of my head.
So how did you, I'll keep on Reddit here instead of Medium because I'm not signed in here. How did you start to connect H.W. Bush and the Bush family to Magenta? Because Magenta, of course, is a case, for anybody that doesn't know, is a case that occurred in 1933 in Magenta, Italy. It was a crashed lenticular object that was taken in by Mussolini. Mussolini had theorized that this was an Allied experimental aircraft, American or British, but some of his engineers, such as the RB, why can I remember right now? The RB and a number thought this was sort of an NHI craft or early thoughts of this. And then eventually information was channeled to the Americans from Pope Pius the, I can't remember, and eventually in the Pius the 12th. And in the closing years and days of World War II, somehow the Americans were able to get their hands on this craft. So how the heck did you connect that with Alan Dulles and the Bush family?
So really, I have to give most of the credit to 36, 39 here, you know, and Harry before that, before he kind of dropped his mic on Reddit. I think, you know, Dulles had been coming up a lot and I wasn't even that familiar with him, you know, and so much of this has been a true history lesson outside of the topic, you know, in terms of the inner workings of the CIA and all that stuff. And it's funny, you know, I've been going back, you know, kind of building, I've made a couple of supercuts the last few days, you know, of times that Grush and other people will discuss this case. And he explicitly says, you know, like the OSS retrieved this, like, you mm-hmm. know, went on to the CIA, et cetera. So it was kind of put in our hands right away, but I think some of us had gotten there in a roundabout way, you know, and seeing Dulles pop up, you know, and then learning about OSS. And then it was like, the more I kept going back and even towards the end of this kind of thread series, it was just like, this is so crazy. This is all one story. You know, this is all like a small group of people. You know, if you go back to Brown Brothers Harriman, it was Herbert Walker, who was Prescott Bush's father-in-law.
And Prescott Bush was H.W. Bush's father, correct?
Right. So then it's Prescott Bush is running that company with Avril Harriman. Later, Harriman goes on to become, I think he's Eisenhower's Secretary of State. And he's calling a lot of shots in the government, you know, post-47. Mm-hmm. So it's the two of them at this agency. Eventually, Alan Dulles is lead counsel there. Some of these folks knew each other from Yale. There's a huge Skull and Bones connection. I realized again towards the end of this that Skull and Bones was a primary recruiting source for the CIA at the behest of Prescott Bush. So you really, I mean, we started to see how a lot of this power, you know, was very, very centralized, you know, within a small group of people, you know, and that George H.W. Bush was eventually at the head of it. You know, he's kind of brought into the fold in the 40s after he graduated from Yale.
H.W. Bush was as kind of a higher up in the CIA. He was kept under wraps for a while, right? Up until his almost presidential run.
Right. And it came out in 88 when he was running for for presidency. There was a paper called The Nation. I think it's a UK paper. And the journalist had found out that Bush had lied about how long he'd been in the CIA. you know, he said he'd been brought in 76 as the director, but really he was traced back to like 61, you know, and apparently he was briefed about JFK, you know, within the week after the assassination. And then people have been commenting, you know, the last week or so, there's been some closer connections there possibly about him being in Dallas and taking a flight around and making some anonymous phone call and all this stuff. And
So one of the things that really kind of part one of your research relies on is a book that Sheehan was kind of advertising on his shelf during an interview. That's this right, book guys. Is called Nazi Hydra in America, Suppressed History of a Giant. Right. And this was featured on his shelves. And throughout right. this book, this talks about how Prescott Bush helped like the Nazis' ascension in kind of alongside the Brown brothers and Harriman and so forth. So can you talk a little bit more about that, how Prescott Bush and the Bush family was actually kind of entwined with the OSS as well as Hitler's ascension and kind of the fascist party rise in the US there in the 30s?
Yeah, I mean, those guys helped fund the business plot in 33, which was kind of parallel with Hitler at the time, you know, in that they were trying to basically overthrow FDR after he was inaugurated and install, you know, a fascist dictator. Mm-hmm. And that failed, you know, sort of Hitler's plan. And eventually, yeah, I'll forget some of the details.
Yeah, no worries.
Fresh still, but you know, those guys were at the core of banking and Wall Street and the steel industry and shipping and a bunch of stuff. And yeah, they were actively funding the Nazis and set up a separate bank, basically, specifically for that, you know, and that they got in trouble for that later. But it was all the same people, you know, it was Prescott Bush. I don't think Harriman was involved with that. You know, I think he was actually pretty upset because he was Jewish, or he was Jewish or his wife was Jewish, but he went to Germany and came back and forced his brother to close their office in Hamburg. Once he saw what was happening, I think in like 35 or 36.
So one of the players you also talk about on the American side of things, of course, we talked a little bit about Prescott Bush, George H.W. Bush. We'll talk more about Alan Dulles, but is James Angleton, who later on in his life became an OSS agent. This was the kind of intelligence organization that preceded the CIA. Angleton was a child in 33 living in Magenta, Italy. Was he not?
He was in Milan. He was like 3 miles.
He was in away. Milan, 3 miles.
Yeah. So and it's possible firsthand witnesses, or they definitely heard about it.
And he was the youngest agent under Bill Donovan at the time, right?
Yeah.
He was
like 16 or 17. Yeah.
So of course, now with these early days, have you been able to make any connections with specifically Dick Cheney and kind of the Bush legacy of the Magenta crash?
Only in that Prescott was there. Like Prescott for sure knew about it. Mm-hmm. And you got Dulles, Donovan, Angleton, most of these people were Yale. It's like right. The whole Bush family was Yale Skull and Bones. Angleton was Yale, maybe Skull and Bones. Donovan was Yale, maybe Skull and Bones. Dulles, I forget, but they were all part of the same like white elite, you know, university dudes who, you know, basically formed the OSS.
Right, because of 36, 39, 42, some of the crux of his research in the Magenta case is analyzing Alan Dulles and the good old boys and how they arranged the intelligence to kind of get the UFO out of, whether it was Germany or Italy at the time, but post-World War II, specifically revolving around Alan Dulles. That's how most of his research applies. And right, I find it really interesting you were able to bring Skull and Bones into this. If any of you don't know Skull and Bones, especially for our European audience, Skull and Bones is a US-based secret society. Think of in the early 2000s when Alex Jones infiltrated the Bilderberg group. Skull and Bones is a Yale society. Who knows what they get up to? I think there's rumors that they burn like an owl effigy or just do very strange stuff. But throughout It's so strange, but you were able to connect. Let me find some of these members. You were able to connect guys like Alan Dulles, George H.W. Bush, Prescott Bush, and so forth to this secret society. How does, would you say, Skull and Bones relates to kind of OSS, CIA, and legacy possible programs?
I mean, I guess, you know, because it just so happened that it was those guys that were coming out of, you know, not just that university, you know, but that specific, you know, secret society, fraternity, whatever you want to call it. And then those were the guys that formed the OSS, you know, and then in 47, those were the guys that formed the CIA post Roswell. So it was kind of like they've been in on this the entire time.
Especially because there's one individual here I'd like you to expand on a little more. Richard Bissell, who declined to be in the Skull and Bones, but by this I can assume he attended Yale. Tell us what he said to Harold Malmgren, former president, father of presidential advisor and very, very senior member, Harold Malmgren, sorry.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was really new to me. You know, I know that went pretty viral, you know, at least in this community, when he tweeted that out. But yeah, I think he said in 63 that Bissell had told him, you know, about it, an exotic, you know, reverse engineering program NHI, you know, tech basically. And then it turned out that, yeah, Bissell was at Yale at the same time. He declined to be part of Skull and Bones, but his brother was in it. So there's a good chance he knew those guys back then as well. You know, he was brought in. I don't know his history. I haven't read that much into it yet. But, you know, in 47, he's asked by Avril Harriman of Brown Brothers Harriman to basically run the Marshall Plan and go over to Europe, talk them into borrowing money from the U.S., you know, for reconstruction. And so you start to see that Bissell, you know, becomes this new figure at the heart of this, you know, and in 50, at some point he's working for the CIA after that. And I think it's in 54 that he decides that Area 51 is going to be a good spot to test out a new aircraft.
Right. Yes, that's a great point. Bissell proposed the site of Area 51.
Right.
And Bissell told Malmgren, I think the exact quote was of like an other world technologies.
That's right. Yeah.
I know that phrase very well because of course I have covered an alleged off-world technologies division. And when Malmgren made those outstanding statements, I can't tell you how many people kind of sent me screenshots of that tweet. Set up the space for Area 51.
Right.
Go ahead.
Real quick with Bissell, I don't remember. I think I had included it. You know, it was kind of at the tail end of things. But so 54, he decides on Area 51. 55 or I think it was 55. He brings the plans for the U-2 to the Air Force, and they turn them down. And so he has CIA pilots test flying the U-2 in Area 51.
Right. And what's interesting about that is Area 51 and the U-2 program out of Area 51 was also sponsored by that remote detachment was sponsored by Edwards Air Force Base, California, who was also laterally connected to reverse engineering programs.
Right. Okay.
So that's also a very interesting point. So yeah. you have in your timeline here, kind of starting in the 1930s with Brown Brothers and Harriman and Bush families and how the Bush family helped Hitler rise to power, but was also instrumental in forming the OSS. You mentioned the Roswell crash in 47. Come 1948, you mentioned a company called Dresser Industries. How do they play into this?
Oh, man. Yeah, this was huge. This tied everything together later on. So Dresser Industries was a company that was bought by Prescott Bush and Alan Dulles, I think. And they used that company to start Zapata Oil in, I think, 51. And they put George H.W. in charge of that. And so this is where a lot of the things where it's like, oh, okay, the same people that have access to this exotic tech are the same people who started Big Oil.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're running things in all directions at the same time. And they're also, of course, directly involved with the CIA. So you can start to see that, like, these things are all part of the same story.
That's something that, although he's quite controversial, that Stephen Greer talks about quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I know in his redacted witness list, he has witnesses from companies that I'm highly suspecting are something like a General Electric, who talk about knowledge of suppressed kind of exotic technologies to kind of reinforce the oil industry and continue dependence on oil and so forth.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
As well as other companies like AT&T and Bell Labs. So he has Greer talks a lot about kind of energy and oil tycoons having knowledge of exotic technologies, but continuing the suppression.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, this is when, you know, things start getting really crazy because you start to realize, like, cool, this is just kind of one empire that's been running the whole show, you know. And as far as Dresser Industries in the 90s, when Cheney, there's so many players and I'm going to forget.
That's all right. There's so many people.
Cheney was Secretary of Defense for Bush. Is that right?
Yes.
George H.W. And at the same time, they're making oil deals and arms deals and stuff. And he's doing stuff with Halliburton. And then after Bush loses, I think Cheney goes into private industry for a little bit. And in 98, Halliburton merges with Dresser Industries. So that's when you start to see these, like, legacy families come together, you know, the Bush empire that had been going on for decades. And then this new Cheney empire that started, I don't know, I guess in the '80s, you know, maybe there's more business dealings before that, but, you start, you know, and you see in 98, like, that's when they joined forces, you know, before the election.
That's fascinating. Research trails like that just kind of uncovered. I'm astonished you were able to pick on some of these intricacies, like Dresser Industries and so forth.
Oh, it's so crazy. Because again, I was just staying up late and doing this, and it was really hard to keep track of it all, especially because I was writing it out, you know, kind of as I found it, you know, because it was so astonishing. And I was worried if I didn't get it all down and post it, I'd forget it, because I was just, there was so much information involved, you know. So that's why I actually started this the night that tweet about Cheney came out, because I was like, oh, okay, there's something really, really here then. You know, I have to really get this out of my head and get it all down. And yeah, just the more I kept digging, it was just like, oh, like every single time I was writing these out, you know, it was just like, this is all completely insane.
Now, I find it so interesting. What was the interview in which the interviewer states that Grush said that Cheney sat on top of the pyramid? Who was the interviewer? I can't remember the show.
It was Walter Kern. Walter Kern is, I think, the editor-in-chief of the County Highway, which is the new print-only newspaper that came out last summer. And I think the second issue did that interview with Grush that I didn't know about till a few months ago.
And then, of course, there's the 2000-2001 radio show in which a researcher, Grant Cameron, who from Presidential UFO called in asking Cheney about programs. And Cheney said, if I was briefed into one, it'd probably be classified and I couldn't talk about it.
Right. And I might have forgotten to include it. But 4 years later, in 2005, there's a story I found from the Herald Tribune where Cameron was trying, I think he was trying to fly. He flew into California to attend some UFO convention or something. And I think he wanted to try and track down Cheney, and Customs stopped him, and they made him go back to Canada.
Oh, I haven't read that.
Yeah. I might've forgotten to include that in the post, but so yeah, I mean, Cameron knows a lot of stuff, you know, obviously.
Have you had a chance to dive into his file base? I used a lot of his internal research files for my Kexburg research?
No, I feel like I'm actually behind on a lot of people as far as this stuff goes, because it's like, I think we're all just consuming different things at different times. And then, you know, that's when we start to kind of Voltron it all together.
Right.
You know, because it's just so big, you know, and I think that's the point, you know.
I wouldn't be too hard on yourself there. Cameron has I think he posted a picture of his office before he uploaded all of his documents, and he had an entire office filled with just papers. I've only scratched the surface of going through his files on Eric Walker, Lyndon B. Johnson, and kind of James Webb. So there is so much more to go.
I don't even know how any of those people are involved. Yeah. So
let's hop on to part three. Part three and four, I think, were actually combined, right?
Yeah, I posted them. I think I was having trouble. I was posting too soon or something.
Oh, so okay. I
wrote them both pretty quickly.
So in part, what was the crux of kind of part four that you were talking about? You mentioned a lot more of players of Alan Dulles, his death. You were talking a little bit about Gerald Ford, which was pretty interesting. The church committee and so forth, a little bit about Cheney and Rumsfeld. So what was a little bit of the crux of your research here in this part?
Yeah, I think that was, yeah, again, I mean, these were almost stream of consciousness. I don't really remember exactly. Right. I think it was tracing back how everybody knew each other and knew probably about, you know, this subject, you know. And so you've got Nixon, who was Eisenhower's VP, you know, and Eisenhower, you know, very famous stories about him and, you know, possible, you know, meetings and agreements and stuff. So, of course, Nixon probably knew something, too. And then I'm forgetting exactly, but I think it was in the 60s that Ford and Cheney and Rumsfeld first all met working, mm-hmm. Working, whatever they were doing. I forget exactly now, but those guys go back to the mid 60s, basically, you know. And then in the 70s, when Ford takes office after Nixon resigns, you know, he installs Bush as CIA director following the church committee. You know, basically the CIA was in shambles post Watergate, you know, they were completely busted. And so they install Bush. After Bush has had this very strange career, you know, of having, I think he was in office for like 2 years as a senator or something. And then, you know, it's like the envoy to China or ambassador to China and some other cushy role, and just kind of strange stuff there. And then, so at that time, you've got Ford, Bush, Rumsfeld was, I forget, like Secretary of State maybe for Ford. And then Cheney becomes White House Chief of Staff, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I think Cheney was a staffer for Rumsfeld. And so then when Rumsfeld is given the role of Secretary of State, he recommends that Cheney take over as Chief of Staff. So right. Then you've got all of these guys. You've got Bush, Ford, Cheney, Rumsfeld going back.
And then here you talk a little bit also about Jimmy Carter and also his involvement with Sheehan, which I found so interesting because, of course, before he took office, Carter was pretty outspoken about UFOs and wanting to investigate the situation because he had his own personal sighting. And then while he was president, Carter wanted to move a little bit off of oil and so forth. And according to Sheehan, I've talked about this a few times, Sheehan was sent by Jimmy Carter to access the classified section of Blue Book files. And that is where the infamous story, he saw a photo of a crash retrieval with symbols drawn on it. You mentioned Michael Schratt's drawings of those. I kind of wanted to bring those up too while we discuss this incident, because this is great. So Michael Schratt, I think, held a drawing competition for the alleged crash that Sheehan discussed. And I think this was 79, right? 79?
No, this is 77. So the story that Sheehan has been telling is that I think it was like 9 days after Carter was elected, you know, that was kind of prime interest to him. And he summoned Bush down to his home at Savannah And, you know, just asked him, like, cool, like, what's going on with this UFO stuff? And Bush told him, like, I'm only going to tell you if you keep me on as director. You know, Carter said, no, it's fine. And so he ousted Bush when he took office and then had Sheehan, yeah, go into the Blue Book, you know. However that worked out, you know, he actually got in and found this photo and, you know, made that drawing and everything.
And then there's the famous story, of course, I don't know if this is validated or not, of Jimmy Carter receiving some sort of briefing to some extent on UFOs and basically was left in a catatonic crying state. I don't know if that story's been substantiated or not. I've spent enough time looking into that.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty popular. And I think, I forget. Somebody had commented recently that, yeah, one of those other guys may have been like in the room when he got that.
Ooh, briefing. Okay.
Yeah, I forget who exactly. And I don't know if I put it in any of the threads. I think it was after I wrote all of this stuff. But yeah, I mean, even if you look at the 77 timeline, so Bush is out as director, and Carter does away with the Atomic Energy Commission. There's some other particulars that I'll forget.
That splits into the DOE and NNSA. A lot of people don't look at records or pay attention to the NNSA. They only pay attention to the DOE in regards to legacy programs. However, that's especially right. Back in the 80s, NNSA was cataloging reports of UAP over nuclear sites throughout the U.S.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I didn't know that.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were talking about 1977, the dissolution.
I mean, I think what makes sense to me is that, you know, he goes to Bush, gets denied. Bush is out. He does away with the Atomic Energy Commission, I think, in like right away, February or March. Mm-hmm. He asked Sheehan go in. I forget. I think that might have been March as well. I think Carter gets briefed in May or June, and then immediately signs into law the DOE. Mm-hmm. And the DOE becomes established in like mid-August, I think. And so it's like, he knows this tech exists. He's coming off of the oil crisis. You know, I'd done a completely different project years ago. I did a lot of research into that stuff, you know, OPEC and all that. So I think there's a very clear timeline in that, like, Carter knows this is all real, you know, and he knows we can be doing something better and we can be off of oil. But I think the grand irony is that, you know, he establishes the DOE, which is set up at the James Forrestal building of all places. and then they use the DOE just to keep hiding all the same stuff.
Right. Yeah. Of course, in 54, there's the Atomic Energy Agreement, which to this day, keeps materials from ever being declassified UAP materials, as they can be misclassified as transnuclear foreign material. And then, of course, the DOE and NNSA have other regulations. Something I was surprised to learn in one of my recent projects was of some of the hypothetical reverse engineering and craft programs out at Nellis, Area 51, and so forth, that DOE owns much of the land there in the Nevada test and training range.
Right. And I learned a lot of that recently, too. I think they also own the land at Los Alamos. And so that's kind of this weird deal where they own the land, they lease it to the contractors, and I think also to the military. And so they are kind of the umbrella over a lot of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm understanding like what it means if they, you know, was admitted by was it Stephanie Granholm?
I think so.
Where they, you know, Burchett and Luna corner her, you know, make her admit that the DOE works with JSOC sometimes. And this famous story of the firefight between JSOC and Lockheed, and Coulthard even validated that a couple of weeks ago and said, yeah, that, you know, might not be the only one. So I'm still kind of making sense of a lot of that stuff. The DOE to the contractors and the military, but then the how does the DOE then have its own retrieval team apart from those people?
Yeah, no, I think that retrieval team is likely the Nest teams, something I've talked about a couple times in the Jonathan Weygandt story. Have you heard of Nest?
It's like the
nuclear emergency search team.
Okay,
so one of the interesting things is guess which company Nest is, one of the contractors Nest is housed out of. EG&G, which we'll talk about in 1 second. So DOE has even more ties, because I can't wait to launch into this part, because this is where I think I can add a little bit of really interesting pieces. Tell me how the heck you connected EG&G and the Carlyle Group into this, because the Carlyle Group especially, I don't think nearly enough people talk about. And once we talk about that, I'm going to connect Carlyle Group to modern day disinformation with Sean Kirkpatrick. So that'll be a bit fun.
Okay. I've been curious, like, where they stand now. Okay. It was when Ross, you know, gave that talk and ended it with bringing up EG&G. So EG&G was a high-speed photography company, you know, run by three guys. Like, those were their initials, funny enough. Mm-hmm. And they were brought in to film the nuclear test. And I think it was also because of them, probably, that they were catching, you know, the craft or orbs or whatever were showing up around these test sites. And who knows what else they caught. And then post Roswell, you know, I think it was like December 47, at the behest of the military, they were basically asked to become, I'm forgetting now, like a joint enterprise or something, so they could be contracted out, however that stuff all works. And so it sounds like basically they became the lead contractor, like they were where things went private kind of right away.
Mm-hmm.
So that the military could do what they wanted, but all the paperwork was at EG&G basically. And then, you know, wherever people stand on Lazar and all that, you know, I think it was Bob Eschler, you know, who said back in the 90s that EG&G was his employer. They are basically the employer Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they run Janet Airlines, you know, it's like they kind of run a lot of that show.
Which that confirmation of EG&G working or employing people at Area 51 was later confirmed, and who we'll talk about in a second with Eric Tabor and his Aero testimony.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I'm not familiar with that.
EG&G also, interestingly enough, as I'm sure a lot of people know, is the parking lot where Admiral Thomas Wilson and Eric Davis met for the classic Wilson Davis notes, which is great. So you hear in this post connected Ross Coulthard, and we kind of started off talking about this within this this engineering badge from Area 51 here. What did you take away from this? And then we'll talk about Eric Tabor, who this was his patch from his great uncle, I believe it was.
Is he the guy? That's right. Okay. I think he saw it, and then after his uncle died, like his uncle told him a story or something. Mm-hmm. Right. This is, again, you know, when I first saw this, Coulthard straight up says, like, oh, the internet's going to go crazy over this.
Right.
And I don't remember really seeing many people talk about it at all.
No.
So I posted it back then, just like, what does anybody think this means? And people just came at me for getting the Star Trek references wrong.
Oh, really?
And I was
Star Trek nerds take their stuff seriously.
Yeah, I mean, sure. You know, it was just like, that's a very ancillary part of this. But he does say that, you know, that I forget what it is. Was it 1100-1001?
Yes.
So it's a reference to a specific Next Generation episode about the Bynars who steal. I watched it a couple times after I read this. The Bynars who steal the Enterprise to go help their planet or something. And it ends with, like, why didn't you just ask us for help?
Right.
And I think it's like Picard and I'll get the other guy's name wrong. They're like, oh, we didn't. Or no, it was some. Yeah, I think they asked the Bynars, like, why didn't you just ask us for help? And they're like, oh, we didn't know if you would. So we just kind of, you know, did things on our own. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's part of the story, that some faction of NHI or something, or you know, getting help without our agreement, or I don't know. I really don't know, you know. And then, but I did see, digging into this more, than Measure, Analyze, Protect. It might have been C. Britton or somebody else had found that that phrase comes up a lot in a lot of the DOE.
So for anybody watching that doesn't know the story of this patch, this originated from Aero Whistleblower, who conveniently wasn't mentioned in the historical report, Eric Tabor, who I think in 2023, he testified to Aero that his great uncle, I think his last name was Urquhart or something. He worked at Area 51 in the capacity of a sergeant from 1997 to 2014 as the head of security for like a radar cross section facility at Area 51. And here he was privy to like images and photographs and so forth of a classic egg-shaped craft that, according to what the uncle told Eric Tabor, was just found abandoned in the desert. So supporting kind of the donation theory that Grush talked about, a seamless egg-shaped craft, maybe the size of a family car. Let's see if we can find an image of it, because I actually have the article pulled up here. And I'm sorry for the Daily Mail's ad pop-ups. I don't have an ad block right here. Yes, I use this image quite a bit. This is Eric Tabor.
What year was that again?
His uncle, Eric Tabor, testified in 2023. Sam Yurka, I cannot pronounce that last name on the fly, was an Area 51 contractor from 97 to 2014. And Tabor is an aerospace engineer, pretty well respected. Sorry, let me find images of that patch. Yeah.
Wait, did he say when he saw that craft?
No, I can't remember. He didn't give an exact date during the time. But of course, Tabor says his uncle was a contractor at Area 51 on the behest of EG&G.
Which is, to me, part of, I mean, every now and then there's some kind of cosmic humor in this. That you've got, you know, an egg-shaped craft at, you know, EG&G facilities.
Oh, okay. So actually, maybe we do have a date. He said when he first got there in 1997, I had a personal conversation with a senior EG&G engineer whose group was tasked with trying to reverse engineer an object that was brought there by some CIA people in the 1980s. Which, maybe. That's interesting to me, because that might talk about the CIA and CIA, OGA, and JSOC participating in retrievals even before kind of the start of the OGA in 2003.
Right.
2002, right. 2001. But that, of course, is for foreign retrievals. So who knows what kind of retrieval teams the CIA may have had their hands in.
Yeah, just bring it back to that. Yeah, eventually. Do you know when, I was trying to find this the other day, when in 2003 OGA became its own agency?
No, I'm trying to think back to Chris Sharp's reporting, but I can't remember exactly when. I don't know if a date is listed there.
Because I think it's, well, you haven't read part 8 yet, and that's when things get really fun.
Ooh, okay. So we'll continue on so we can get to part 8. Now, one of the companies that ran EG&G from 1997 to 2001 that you bring up is, of course, the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group has been implicated many times as one of the lead proponents of the control group of the UAP topic. What did you find out about the Carlyle Group within this piece, part 5?
Oh, man. I'm not sure how some of that info was divvied up between these. Yeah, it just really stuck out to me that they were... So they made a deal in 96 with the Saudis, Saudi royalty, and that money goes back to the Bush family, back to at least 51 with Zapata Oil. Mm-hmm. You know, so those guys have been working together a long time. And I think over time, you know, EG&G kept getting split up into like different not branches, but like different sub holding companies or something.
Right.
And so it just stuck out that you've got, you know, Carlyle, it turns out that their board was Bush, his Secretary of State, James Baker.
Mm-hmm. UK Prime Minister, John Major.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Carlucci, who was part of his staff, and I'm forgetting another guy who was part of his staff. So it was like Bush and three of his top White House people all basically at the head of Carlyle Group alongside billionaire Jeff Rubenstein.
Right. So in 1987, David Rubenstein, he was the domestic policy advisor to Carter when he started the Carlyle Group.
Right. That's right.
And yeah, yeah. That's funny you mentioned Frank Carlucci. I need to know if one of my guys, Kai, is in the chat right now. Kai is really big into the subject of ARV, as Greer puts it. And that mention of Frank Carlucci, if he's here, I need to bring something up to him real fast, because Frank, the specific mention of Frank Carlucci with the Carlyle Group is what I think is one of the most consequential mentions here. I know it's like a one sentence thing when you got heavy hitters like Rubenstein and the Bush family and the dozens of Saudi investors within Carlyle Group. But
right.
how familiar are you with the Mark McCandless story? And Kai, if you're in the chat, please comment, because I know you're going to love this.
Definitely. Maybe if I got a refresher, I feel like the name sounds kind of familiar, but yeah.
Okay, so Mark McCandless was an aerospace illustrator who testified at Greer's Disclosure Project briefing in 2001.
Okay.
Mark McCandless did tons of aerospace work, was a very well-respected artist with Lockheed Martin, various defense contractors. In 1988, his fellow aerospace illustrator, Brad Sorensen, invited Mark McCandless to go to Norton Air Force Base, California for an air show. McCandless had some last-minute projects for, I think it was Popular Mechanics, so he ended up not going. Brad Sorensen, when he went to Norton Air Force Base, saw the air show, saw some experimental craft, but he was with an individual that he described to Mark later on. And this individual and Brad Sorensen, allegedly, but I think this is far more than just an alleged story, because I'm going to cover it in the near future and I have some additional info on this story I think people might find interesting, are taken to a kind of wardened off section of this airbase at Norton and admitted by a general or a two or three star general, Air Force general. And the individual that Brad Sorensen is with says that Brad is his aide, so they can get in. Here there are three flying saucer craft referenced as alien reproduction vehicles. This is where the term is coined. They function off of electrogravitic or zero point technologies. They're the classic flux liner design, if you've ever heard of that.
Yeah.
It's three craft sizes, the smallest one being like 40 feet across, the largest one being like 100, 200 feet across,
oh, wow.
All with similar designs, all with oxygen tanks sitting radially in the craft, all with like capacitor plates on the bottom, all with a crew compartment with, I think, three seats facing around each other. This is a very interesting story because McCandless made a new, let me pull up the drawing of the flux liner just so people can see this while I talk about it.
So one funny thing too, to kind of backtrack a tiny bit about the Watertown stuff, is that that was one of the locations at Area 51. And there's a specific EG&G office that is opened on July 24th, 1969, the day the astronauts come back.
Oh, interesting.
That office gets established, and then later, I don't know the timeline here, but later the DOE is at that exact same address.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So the point I bring up about the ARV, Mark McCandless and Brad Sorensen, is because that senior advisor that took Brad to this classified section of this air show was none other than Frank Carlucci.
Oh, wow.
So that's a really, really, really damn interesting connection, because Carlucci is associated with Carlyle Group.
Wait, what? When was the...
November 13th, 1988.
So a year after Carlyle Group is formed.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Mark McCandless was unalived in 2021.
Wait, what's his story?
As an aerospace illustrator, after he was talked to by Brad about these designs, he and Brad worked for concept art for the ARV craft. Over time, he would talk about these craft in zero point systems until 2014. Wow. A documentary filmmaker named James Allen made a documentary called Zero Point Mark McCandless.
Uh-huh.
Before the documentary was ever released, James Allen was diagnosed and killed by a super aggressive form of cancer within the span of weeks. And in his autopsy report, he was also found to have suffered from metal poisoning. About this same time, Mark McCandless said he slept with a gun under his bed out of fear for his life. In 2021, he was found with a gunshot wound to the head.
I think I just heard this the other day, or maybe it was catching up on your last, on your episode from last week. That's right.
Yeah, well, I think we talked about that in live a little bit.
Yeah. But,
so Carlucci and the Carlyle Group may be entwined with reverse engineering practices. And how this goes further is you're probably pretty familiar with Sean Kirkpatrick, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember in 2022, 2023, I can't remember exactly when Arrow did a roundtable talk with Sean Kirkpatrick and former Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security, Ronald Moultrie?
Yeah, I think I watched that when it came out, but I don't remember any of the details really.
So Moultrie was like a huge bigwig. It was here the two said there was nothing to UAP. There was absolutely nothing. Well, Moultrie, as it turns out, sorry, let me reference my notes. Moultrie is a board member for the Better Angels, which was funded by David Rubenstein, the founder of Carlyle Group. And he is a board member in iCapital, which is Carlyle Group's most invested in group. So even Ronald Moultrie now has connections to Carlyle Group. Ronald Moultrie has had influence or is in cahoots with Sean Kirkpatrick previously as well.
Right. Okay.
So I found that
involved with the DOE since he was like 17. Yeah.
So I found and then of course goes to Oak Ridge National Labs once he leaves Arrow. Well,
where everything. Yeah. I mean, Oak Ridge is the entire loop.
Yeah.
So we're just set by Anheuser-Busch, you know, and I think he got the directions to do that in 41 from FDR, sets it up in 42. Whatever the timeline there is for MJ-12, you know, and Anheuser-Busch and everybody else. And then now we're right back to the DOE and Oak Ridge. Yeah. And Kirkpatrick goes there. And yeah,
I just found I was so happy when I read part five, just with EG&G and so forth. I love that because I think those corporations are, EG&G has had some fame because of its association with Bob Lazar, but especially the Carlyle Group. I was so happy you made these ties here.
Yeah. And that was, you know, I tried getting there months ago, you know, but I was still just wrapping my head around everything that was coming out. And that was actually where I wanted specifically to get back to. I didn't even intend to make this huge like series or whatever. You know, I was like, oh, let me just get back to the Carlyle EG&G stuff. And then everything, it was like, as I kept digging, it was like everything kept growing really fast. Mm-hmm. Like, oh man. Okay. This is all huge. This is all one story, you know?
And then of course things get even bigger when we get to part six, where you mention SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation. Right. Now, did you get a chance recently to see Kermit's post on kind of the financials of UAP legacy programs? And he talks about the startup of SAIC after various SEC regulations, which basically allow corporations to keep two books, one on record, one off record, and so forth.
No, I didn't see that. No,
it's a wonderful piece. It harped back to, I think there was one interview in 2021, Lou Elizondo talked about, he referenced two defense contractors under the pseudonyms Company A and Company B and them gaining unfair advantages within the SEC due to having exotic technologies.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the SAIC stuff, I only really know about because of Still Chill Trill. Mm-hmm. They like focus specifically on that eventually, you know, and looking at a lot of the records and stuff. And then going back and forth, we were, you know, again, figuring out timeline, you know, where it looks like basically Blue Book closes at the end of, I think Alan Dulles dies in January 69.
60, yeah.
And then by the end of the year, Blue Book closes. And in that time, I've been able to find an actual month, but at some point SAIC is started. And so it looks like basically that's where Blue Book maybe goes private.
So now I have a way to circle back to your research as well, kind of with SAIC and Malmgren and sorry, I'm forgetting his name, Bissell as well. So Bissell tells Malmgren about Otherworld Technologies, basically a division that studies Otherworld Technologies. I have made a video on an Off-World Technologies division that I, with a lot of research, highly suspect was ran by SAIC. So now even more parallels to your research.
Interesting. So Bissell tells Malmgren this in 63, I think it was.
Yes.
And then, SAIC starts in 69. I haven't had a chance to dig into, you know, any direct connections. It's more just like, it's all at the same time, basically. So
SAIC is so weird. And I'm sure you heard about all the stuff with Chris Sharp and his Liberation Times article in Undersea Retrievals, right?
Well, oh, yeah.
He mentions Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Guess who has plenty of contracts with the Office of Naval Research and the NSW Crane, which is the which is basically a naval research in electromagnetic and expeditionary weapon lab.
Oh, wow.
And Woods Hole, SAIC.
Wow.
So SAIC, Kermit and I talk about this a lot, but they kind of have their hands in every single piece of the pie here. So It just makes so much sense that they would kind of fall into your research.
Yeah, right. Okay. God, this is, yeah. I mean, yeah, the more this keeps going. I mean, I think too, you know, going back over, you know, just building the supercut stuff, you know, I'm looking to make a proper documentary on the Magenta incident and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been going back over, you know, all of Grush's, I mean, outside of Coltart, you know, he did a podcast with Roberto Panatti and Guizzardi and,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then Panatti did a thing with Strieber, talked about it, and it's come up a few other times, but I mean, Grush says right away with Coltart, he's like, yeah, it's retrieved by the OSS,
mm-hmm.
back channeled via the Vatican, OSS becomes a CIA, and he throws it out there, you know. And then when he goes on Rogan, Rogan asks him, you know, about this, you know, and he's like, oh, I just wanted to show that this goes further back and it's international, and I thought that was interesting. And you're like, no, you knew what you were doing. You're making sure that like all of us nerds like really dig into this stuff, you know, because it's not just some other interesting case or just some crash retrieval. It's like everything about who we are as a country and maybe a world kind of starts there.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with the Bush clan getting their hands on this, you know, and again, these people starting the CIA, keeping this stuff secret, running roughshod all over the world, you know, however many coups, you know, they were a part of, you know, just like ugly stuff that is well known, you know, to anyone who reads history at all, you know. And so you start to see like, oh yeah, this is all like just one big kind of evil empire, you know, that it's like, it's true.
And I love the fact that Grush was able to kind of walk things back a little bit, because most people who have just kind of a fleeting interest in the subject think of Roswell as the real start of, you know, possible reverse engineering programs, when some people familiar with MJ-12 might think 1941 Cape Girardeau is kind of the nexus point. But Grush walking it back further to 1933 Magenta. And who knows, are there possible cases before that as well, such as 1897 Aurora, Texas, or the claims of Bob Lazar are true, a craft that was found in an archaeological dig and so forth.
Oh,
so,
right. Yeah, Grush, yeah, I think I heard really recently that, yeah, Lazar said it came from somewhere in like the Southwest.
Oh, like, did he? I didn't know he gave it.
Somebody commented this a few days ago that, yeah, he said something about, yeah, this is really new to me, that I guess, yeah, it was brought in and they think it might have crashed like 1,000 years ago or so.
Wow, that... I've been kept up to date with the kind of...
I don't know. Yeah. And then the Aurora thing, yeah, I was familiar with. I mean, you know, the airship stuff at that time. And
mm-hmm.
and even that's a funny one, because it's like this thing crashes into a windmill.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost like analogous power in a way, you know, that if that was an airship, you know, and it's like if these things are constantly sort of like pushing us to, you know, advance our science. And then you've got, I mean, I've been reading more lately about radar and death rays, which is like pretty new to me. Like radar comes from the search for a death ray, which is basically your first EMP.
Interesting.
Yeah. So you've got like Marconi. Maybe I'll do that tonight.
Yeah.
Marconi, you know, Nobel Prize winner, was put in charge of researching, you're experimenting on the Magenta craft by Enrico Fermi, of all people, who said this whole thing was kind of bullshit.
With a famous Fermi paradox that is very lacking.
It turns out he said while he was walking with Edward Teller and two other people. So I think he was trying to throw somebody else
out. Right.
At Los Alamos.
At Los Alamos. I forgot about that part.
I just learned that recently. But Marconi, you know, he invented radio. And then he was also known for studying electromagnetism in the ionosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if there'd be any way to find out, but I'm really curious if he was testing out his death ray and accidentally brought this craft down.
Interesting. For anybody who doesn't know, Marconi was implicated in the alleged RB-33, the internal Italian documents that stated he was kind of the basically in charge of analyzing this craft that crashed in 33. And then in 2024, Panotti came out with more documents vindicating the actual legitimate creation of RB-33. So that's pretty interesting. But
did you say RB or is it RS?
It might be. It's RS. I'm sorry. I was thinking about the RB-47 jet while I was talking about that.
No, because it was the special research.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. Thank you. And so part seven, this piece was actually taken down. So
that just came down a couple nights ago because I guess it wasn't UFO-centric enough.
What new points kind of can you talk about that you talked about in this one before we move into eight?
I think, where did I end up here? Oh, right. I mean, it's really ended up just being about kind of the crossover between Skull and Bones. And there's a, you know, a pretty famous story about Prescott Bush was a part of this group that dug up at least what they thought. Turns out there was some dispute about whether or not it was really him, but, you know, dug up the grave of Geronimo.
Interesting.
Know? Yeah. Like had his skull at their facility, you know, and just some weird black magic stuff there. And so, you know, you kind of start looking at, and then, you know, they start Zapata Oil, or, you know, Prescott Bush and Dulles, you know, start Zapata Oil in 51 with the help of the CIA, you know, and it turns out it was like a front for the CIA. But even that, it's like, they were sort of like these middle fingers from these white colonizers. It's kind of how I look at it, you know? And so I think part of what's happening now, even just culturally in general, but let alone this topic and, you know, trying to reveal this true history, is like this notion of like ugly colonization before we go anywhere else, you know, before we actually go to Mars and beyond, you know what I mean? It's like, we need to do away with a lot of that notion of colonization. And so I think you start to see like, that's part of what this whole empire has been from the beginning. You know, it's just like these white men with power, you know, and who's hated more on the planet at the moment, you know, it's like the rich white elite basically that have been running things into the ground, you know? And so we get to see kind of where some of that starts, you know, in the modern age at least. And then I ended up on Bohemian Grove, and it turns out it's all the same people, you know, it's Bush, you know, it's like all these kingmakers basically. And that's kind of the joke, you know, that like 36 and still Till and I talk about, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, this is what it is. It's just, these people wanted to be kings, you know?
And Bohemian Grove is similar to Skull and Bones. It's like a secret society that nobody knows what the heck they actually do. I never besides do weird dances.
Yeah. And they, you know, it's worship of an owl and a bunch of other stuff. And we know there's like the Mike Cleland, you know, owl UFO stuff. And, Anna Pasolka has talked about that. And so, yeah, I don't know. I haven't read enough into it. I just kind of know some of that cursory stuff.
So let's move on to part eight. I don't know a dang thing about this. I hadn't read this. I asked you if it came out and you told me yes. So what can you tell me about this? Because I think it involves a little bit of sort of like the black magic you were talking about with Iraq and so forth.
Yeah. And maybe, yeah, I mean, without having predetermined any of this and kind of writing it out, you know, as kind of in real time. I guess to end up at Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove and whatever they were doing there. And then to close off with like Stargate and the Tomb of Gilgamesh. I mean, that was a theme that kept coming up. You know, everyone's been on the hunt for Cold Heart's UFO, Too Big to Move.
Right.
And it's come up a few times that, you know, the U.S. Embassy in Iraq looks like it could be, you know, where this all is. And then I think at some points, you know, a couple of people brought up the fact that the Tomb of Gilgamesh was reportedly found like barely over a week before we invaded. And there's some other stuff too I found recently within like that time frame, I forget, but some weird stuff, some business dealings and stuff. And so that's why I was wondering like when specifically JSOC was set up.
Oh, okay. It would be interesting.
Like all part of this story. If JSOC is answering to Cheney, Cheney's the one who was basically running the Bush administration, just like Bush Sr. was running the Reagan administration. You know, the Bush family through what's their company? Global Defense, which is under Dresser Industries, is one of the contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan. Halliburton famously was the big one. So it's like these guys probably behind 9/11 let it happen. There's a famous, you know, they had a meeting that morning with the Saudis. It's the Carlyle Group and the Saudis. And then 9/11 happens.
Didn't Rumsfeld, I think a couple days before 9/11, talk about like $2 or $3 trillion missing at the Pentagon as well?
The day before.
Day before. Interesting. Yeah.
September 10th. I just read that again.
So you were talking about the Iraqi embassy, I think even before Ross coming out and talking about the massive UFO buried under some sort of construction, there were stories that the Iraqi embassy was built over a UFO, as well as other stories in the kind of somewhat local area of the Middle East. There's some rich moon dust stories, like a 1958 crash retrieval occurring in Kabul, Afghanistan, and so forth. Oh, so okay. There's actually a lot of really rich lore in the Middle East that I don't even think has been begun to be explored until your piece.
So, yeah, I think part of this. So, yeah, I've been kind of hearing that stuff. And then, you know, I haven't read either of the Skinwalker books, but I caught up on an older a podcast from a couple of years ago with George Knapp that kind of re-aired. With, I think, on UAP studies, you know, this was a couple months ago, but he basically walks through the timeline of, you know, Bigelow and NIDS in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then you've got Bass, which is basically where a lot of, you know, UFO reports and stuff are being sent in the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And then whatever happens there to, you know, OSAP and then ATIP. And what really stuck out to me was that he said that when Hunt for the Skinwalker came out, you know, that was Knapp and Kelleher, then it got passed around to people at the DIA in the Middle East, like Lakatsky.
Interesting. And
so you're like, oh, okay, Lakatsky was working for the DIA in the Middle East in 2007. Maybe the year after we build this embassy and they're looking for stuff, you know, like it would kind of makes sense if that was all tied together. And also 2007, I don't know what he was doing, but Kirkpatrick was part of some joint CIA DIA operation. And I know it came out recently. I know Carl Nell was on like the first team that went over there,
mm-hmm,
in 2003. And I think Elizondo was also on another like first team that went over there. So I don't know. Yeah, it's just a lot of stuff around this. And then it gets weirder.
So scrolling through the article, I see you bring up a picture of the alleged Holloman Air Force Base tape, which was actually just talked about by James Fox in his interview with Jesse Michaels. James Fox stated in one of his documentaries, he interviewed a guy that had seen this tape. What is the context here of including this clip or including this image?
I don't remember. What did Cameron say? Something about, because it's Cameron who's been tying Cheney into a lot of this stuff. Like what Carter knew, what Cheney knew eventually.
Right.
I don't remember exactly.
Okay, yeah, you're talking about Grant Cameron and Jimmy Carter here. We mentioned the story of Carter crying. I still don't know. We still don't know if that's a legitimate story or not. Sheehan talking about Carter's election. Let's see if possibly under here. Okay, Jimmy Carter. Oh, cool. Okay, here it is. Okay, so Grant Cameron commented on the on this. So apparently, this 15-minute film was shown to Jimmy Carter. Grant Cameron states this. Grant Cameron's a fantastic researcher. And this film, without reading this clip, just from my head, apparently shows a saucer with three landing gear touching down, a hatch opening up from a smooth surface that doesn't show sort of any sort of view holes, portholes, signs of propulsion, all the classic observables of a craft. A sort of runway comes down, three beings come out. They look like tall humanoid individuals wearing like headgear that a film watchers said looked like Egyptian headdresses. And so James Fox talked about this video quite a bit in his recent interview with Jesse Michaels and said he interviewed, I
I'm
can't
still
remember the
seeing
exact person.
that. Yeah, I'm almost done with that interview.
It's
But
really dang good so far.
yeah, it's great.
Interesting. So according to Grant Cameron, Carter had seen
Oh,
this
so that's what it
footage.
was.
And in the footage, I think like the beings basically start interacting with humans, which is pretty darn interesting. It reminds me a lot of 1957. You know, astronaut Gordon Cooper, he stated while he was stationed at Edwards Air Force Base, he had a survey team film kind of remote parts of the base. And one of his survey teams caught a UAP landing that is same kind of saucer shaped craft, I think 40 feet in diameter. And when his film crew got close, the saucer within 20 yards of the craft, it took off. And he had seen this film and others had, and then apparently it was confiscated. So that sounds very similar. I can't remember the exact date of this. Was this
57.
50? Okay, 50, 57. Yeah. Then the Edwards
Interesting.
might have been 54. So these, I think, were within 3 years, these two supposed films.
Oh, right. Yeah, because 50. I'm trying to, put all this together. Because wasn't. Oh, right. Okay. Because this, I think what I read, and I mean, I don't, a lot of it wasn't verified, but I think there was talk that what I know of Kingman, I know you did your video, which is, I think, probably the best one I saw. I mean, between you and
Appreciate that.
Dolan, this is great too. Kingman, the story that I understand is that there were like eight craft and there was a
Yeah.
dogfight and one crashes into the side of a cliff and it's totally demolished. One crashes into the ground. A guy's brought out to study it, an engineer. And I think there's a dead body, one or two, I forget.
That was the Stansel crash.
Okay, and then a third one is gifted, and that maybe these were like Eisenhower was at all three of the sites or something like that. That it was like the Kingman gifting was at one base, maybe at the Dugway site, which I know Greer's talked about a lot, near Kingman, and then another one was Edwards, and then there was a third one somewhere else. So that like one of these was the sites where possibly Eisenhower made his agreement in 53, or maybe it was
Right.
this before. I'm not really sure.
Because the Kingman, kind of the multiple craft theory, came from Harry Drew. And just like you said, over I think a week in March, 7 days in March, his documentary, there were three separate crashes, one crash, one forced landing with which Arthur Stansel saw, and one kind of gifted craft.
Okay.
Which is very interesting. And that documentary, 7 days in March or 7 days in May, I can't remember, is almost impossible to track down.
I've never heard of it, yeah.
It's a Harry Drew packaged it with a like a book, a limited release DVD. So I know a couple of like researchers who have been trying to track down that dang tape,
That's
but nobody
interesting.
has found it. It seemed like that 53 to 57 region had a or time span had a lot of really interesting contacts, because there's the Edwards Air Force Base touchdown, according to Gordon Cooper. There's the Holloman Air Force Base landing film, according to Grant Cameron now, that Jimmy Carter saw, and there's the Kingman crash, all in the span of 4 years.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's coming after 52, which was a pretty bonkers year as well. Mm-hmm.
And 53 to start, we saw the Robertson panel as well. And 52, we see UFOs over Washington, D.C.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, I haven't read all of the Schellenberger document. You know, I've posted it a couple times, but every 10 pages, I'm just like, I cannot. Like, this is crazy. Like, it's, you know.
That's the timeline debrief for Congress, right?
I think it's 177 pages, or maybe that's just the first document or something. But yeah, it's just like, oh, another craft, more dead bodies, whatever. You know, it's just like so routine for these guys, you know.
You hit the nail on the head. It's exactly 177 pages.
Really? Yeah, yeah. I need to finish it. It was just, it's like every time I started to get through it, it just spun me out so bad. You know, it was like, oh, this is just completely normal. Mm-hmm. It became normal, you know, immediately after Roswell, basically, that like they kept finding, you know, these crashes and these dead beings and stuff. And they didn't care. You know, they were like, oh, okay, just like box them up, you know, we'll take care of them. Like,
have you gotten a chance to read Leonard Stringfield's Crash Retrievals parts 1-7?
I know, I haven't read any of his stuff yet. No.
I'll actually send you the PDF of that. That is so consequential to my research, and I think ufology in general, especially talking about crash retrievals and the subject of bodies. It is so fascinating. And Michael Schrat, this was in 2016, I think, was able to access the archives of Leonard Stringfield, who is now deceased in Cincinnati, and made a whole nother series of kind of crash retrieval cases that Leonard never published, including discussion of the Edwards film as well. So there's a tangible research line for the supposed films of craft touching down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, actually, I got to hang out with Michael Schrat last Sunday.
Oh, did you? Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. You told me.
So I joined the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance early August to try and reach out to producers, you know, for documentary stuff. And so even that was like, oh, I'm like emailing with Steve Bassett and, you know, Dan Harari. And then they had an event last Sunday, and it was, Thomas Jane, Ron James from MUFON, and then Michael Schrat. And then we went to a dinner afterwards, and the location kept getting moved. Just some weird confusion, I guess. So it came down to like eight of us or something. And I'm at this dinner table with like Michael Schrat to my left, Steve Bassett to my right, you know, Dan Harari right in front of me. And I'm just like, oh, okay, I guess this is my world now, you know.
Did you get to talk with Schrat extensively about crash retrievals? Because he's just so well versed on that subject. What did you guys get to talk about?
Yeah, I got to fill him in on Magenta because he didn't know any of the stuff yet.
And right.
He called me the next day. We talked for like 20, 30 minutes about it. And then he wanted to meet up today, but I was like, well, I'm doing this thing. And so
we take precedent over Schrat. I'm honored, man. That's
well, he lives like an hour from me. It's fine. Yeah, he's pretty close.
I know he's been looking for, with his incredible drawings of craft and sightings used like by almost every researcher, he's been trying to find a more concrete description of the Magenta craft to be able to draw. Because I think the only real description we have is from Grush, like a lenticular shape.
Yeah, right.
Two saucers pressed against each other. That's slightly damaged, but hull integrity intact.
Right, right.
I don't think there's...
I mean, that's kind of what I walked him through, and I was showing him. I don't know if he'd seen the Daily Mail article on that. It's the only big one that I've seen, but yeah, I was just showing him. I'm like, I don't know, this is all I've seen. And so, you know, I know that and whatever Grush said, you know, and so that's what he was trying to, you know, get down to. It was just like, what are the exact dimensions? How exactly, you know, did it crash? I'm like, I don't know. I'll send you some stuff.
Still have a... All the way dating back to the Magenta case, have you been able to kind of tie in any of the mega defense conglomerates like Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop Grumman into your work as well, alongside the EG&G, Carlyle, SAIC, and some of the oil conglomerates?
No, I mean, that stuff has been too confusing for me just to understand like the parallels, you know, between the defense contractors. I mean, I know... You know, Lockheed works directly with the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really understand, like, this, where the CIA, basically, where, I don't know where the CIA and the Air Force split, because it seems like that's part of this story.
Yeah, it seems like, yeah, especially where's the difference? Because there's a lot of joint teams in JSOC, right, that can operate under CIA's directive or any sort of directive. And the Air Force has quite a few teams. 24th STS, the old classic Blue Berets and so forth. Mm-hmm. The Air Force is very interesting, but so is also the naval involvement as well, as outlined by Chris Sharp.
Yeah, right.
In his recent article, I think after his third edit, because I think there was some trouble with Dean Johnson.
Oh, right. I saw all that. Yeah.
But I try to extend an apology to him because I had talked about the original edit that Sunday before any of that drama came out. So I felt bad if I had implicated him in anything bad, like the threats he said.
What happened there? Yeah. I'm confused though. I wasn't paying enough attention. What happened with all that?
So September 20th is when the article is released. September 22nd, I did a live, and I remember I had read the article when it first ever, the second it came out, and I was gobsmacked to see mention of the National Underwater Reconnaissance Office, CIA, Office of Science and Technology, NRO, NGA, Lockheed Martin, and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And come the 22nd, that had been edited out. So thankful to the Wayback Machine, I was able to talk about the original version of that article. And then that week on Twitter, Dean Johnson, I guess, called Chris Sharp out or something. And Chris Sharp stated that he had received threats due to the original article. So he re-edited everything out there and basically expanded on the fact, or not the fact, but the allegations that Woods Hole, in accordance to kind of NRO, the Underwater Reconnaissance Office, will retrieve craft due to their very unique submersibles and then pass them on to the Office of Naval Research for testing alongside defense contractors.
Yeah, okay. Just another thing.
I feel like for so long the Navy's been overlooked in terms but going back to the nexus of like Air Force Regulation 200-2 and JANAP 146C, in which the USAF kind of restricted UFO reporting methods and like incurred a $10,000 fine if commercial pilots reported UFOs. The Navy did the same thing with OPNAV 3820. So the Navy was right there with the Air Force back in the heyday of kind of restricting UFO reporting.
Gotcha. Okay. This is so bonkers.
And then, of course, there's corporations that tie into every single piece of this, whether that be Lockheed Martin, SAIC, EG&G.
Right. And I think, I mean, that's the way we've all, or in our little chat, kind of been joking about it too. It's just like, well, it makes sense. I mean, all of this makes sense now, you know. I think half jokingly to sort of talk about a lot of this is being almost biblical in a general sense, you know, that there are these revelations coming out and there's so much at play all at the same time. You know what I mean? It's like we've got the craziest political upheaval we've ever had. We've got climate crisis. We just watched the crazy flooding yesterday, you know, on the East Coast. You know, just so much, you know, income inequality and disparity and all these things and all these reckonings happening on a cultural level and socioeconomic level while all of this stuff is happening as well. You know, and it's almost like, this entire system has been built up and this is like when it all kind of comes down, you know. It's like a giant, this is the house of cards basically, you know. And so even to talk strictly about all the different contractors, it's like this whole thing is so unwieldy, you know. And like the way, you know, Dana Psilka talked about like the Fight Club, you know, it's like that thing's making more sense now that like just all these people have it, you know.
Yeah, the picture of corporations involved and contractors, as well as USG specific three-letter agencies and USG military branches that are involved, is starting to become a bit clear. And it's been very fascinating to follow these revelations and see how like a JSOC, OGA, ONR, NRO, NRO, NGA, and so forth is implicated. It's so interesting. I wonder if the Magenta craft, where it's being housed now, if there's still sort of efforts being done on it, or it's just kind of cataloged away in like an Indiana Jones relic warehouse. Yeah, and so
forth. I mean, what was Burchett's joke? That, like, every time you name him, the U-Haul truck shows up.
And takes stuff away.
Yeah. I mean, my best guess is that initially it might have been taken to Oak Ridge, you know, because, you know, Vannevar Bush gets the memo from, I think, from FDR or from Marshall. I forget. There's some of the three of them are talking, basically, you know, so he gets to setting up Oak Ridge, you know, and this is also following the Cape Girardeau incident. So, you know, if they had everything at that time, at least, you know, had everything in one place, because there was no Edwards Air Force Base or anything. Who knows now where any of this stuff is, you know?
And I found it interesting in later cases, especially in the 60s and the 70s, how often mention is made of kind of rotating warehouses of where craft are stored. One perfect example is Kecksburg, that is supposedly taken to Lockburn Air Force Base in Ohio first, and then shipped to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. There's also the testimony of an anonymous witness, RB, in Stringfield's files, that talked about guarding a craft about 3 hours outside of a base in South Carolina, and that every 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it would be rotated through.
Oh, really?
And also, yeah. In a project I'm covering now, there's stories of a reverse engineering testing team that's rotated through every 6 months for program security. So possibly not only are materials transferred around and shipped around, but personnel are too. But is that kind of an old method, or is that still ongoing?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know that side of things at all. I haven't heard any of that stuff.
But it's just, what do you have next for your research? Where do you plan on going next?
I don't know. I have to I have to figure out personal stuff. I've been so down this rabbit hole. I don't know. I mean, I've been looking into the death ray stuff, which is really interesting. And, you know, Marconi playing around with that stuff, and Tesla playing around with that stuff, and, you know, John Trump, you know, Donald Trump's uncle, who is basically given all of Tesla's files after he dies. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he had, what was it? He was in the X-ray business. And then I think when it was announced we were going to World War II, he got into radar. And so it's funny that he's the one who's given Tesla's documents. You know, if Tesla was also, if radar came from the death ray, and that's what John Trump specifically was also working on, was radar stuff. But, you know, if you've watched Simon Hollis, you know, that's kind of where I sort of started locking onto that, you know, that we understood more about radar early on than we let anybody know, that it was all derived from an F-ray. And it basically was an EMP, you know, early on. So, and then it makes sense that it's, you know, partly responsible for a lot of these crashes early on as well. You know,
there's early stories, especially with Roswell, that some sort of radar interference it messed with a craft's inner circuitry, or however the craft are powered. That's an awesome rabbit hole.
Oh yeah, that's fun. Yeah, I mean, I was watching I don't know if you saw the Falcon crew guys who got the part of the Arts Parts a couple months ago, and we're testing it.
They've been doing material analysis
a little bit, and they were super public right away, you know, they were live streaming it all, but they got a little bit of it anonymously, and or by a source who wanted to stay anonymous, and I just happened to catch it that day, and they were looking at it, and it matches up with so much other stuff that a lot of us have heard about, the terahertz waveguide stuff, and how it basically acts as a superconductor, and it would make sense, you know, if it's 3D printed material and there's a lattice honeycomb structure inside of it. So it makes sense if the power gets transferred up. It's this really beautiful way, basically, that, you know, the whole thing gets powered. And yeah, it's pretty wild. I mean, I had a sighting once that kind of lines up with some of that stuff.
Oh, what'd you see?
I've had a few, but This was the closest one. This was back in January, not far from my house. I saw two. I'm assuming it was two. They were in the clouds, and so I didn't see any like structure, but I basically just saw the underside of like the, I'm guessing like electromagnetic waves that were powering these things, you know, and one was like this beautiful amber and one was this beautiful violet, and they were really close together, moving really slow. Like,
wow. Do they have any like change in direction? Could you see kind of a shape of a craft?
I mean, they were saucer shaped. But I didn't see any like hard craft surfaces or anything. They were like, yeah, just inside the clouds. And I was like coming in from hanging out in my backyard and looked up and right there, they just moved really slow. And I kind of waved and said hi, and they took off into the clouds real slow. And I was like, okay.
Interesting. Now you said you could see kind of like an electromagnetic discharge. What you could see kind of a visible wave pattern.
Yeah. There's I keep meaning to find these and save them. There's two images I've seen. One is of one went around a month or two ago. It's like a coin. I forget from where, but one side is like of a craft, and then the other side is like a straight up reptilian, like smiling or something. And there's another image from like this famous historical image from Italy, from Rome or something. Was very similar to where the craft, it's like these grooves on the bottom. And so it kind of like, if you can imagine, like, let's say 8 or 10 grooves on the bottom, and it's kind of like each one had its own like energy field.
Interesting.
So all I could see was the energy, basically.
Kind of like of a saucer shape.
Yeah. Yeah. It was beautiful. Yeah. It was wild.
That sounds fascinating.
And it was, I mean, yeah. I was having like a particularly bad night too. So it was kind of funny when you talk about the psychic connection and whatever all of that means, you know, it was kind of like, yeah, I was having a rough one, and it was like came out from under my carport and looked up and they were just right there.
Wow. I
was like, oh, okay. Thanks.
That is incredible.
And I went back in and kept playing video games. Yeah.
Jeez. Well, Voller, I'll let you go now. I got 20 minutes until a hard stop, and I usually do a tiny bit of a Q&A right before, but real fast, where can we gonna,
do you want to speed run through part 8 real quick?
Yes, please. Yes.
Okay. Cheney, supposedly, so apparently the story of a Stargate was going around in the 1920s in Iraq, and a lot of the world's rich and elite were kind of obsessed with it. Apparently, some of this isn't in there. Apparently, Saddam Hussein found it in like the late 80s. And so when we went to war in 90, that's a big part of what they were looking for, Bush and Cheney. And I guess Cheney was like obsessed with the idea of a Stargate, you know, and this like ultimate power and time and space and all this weird stuff. Some people have reached out to me to say that like when we invaded in 2003, that was specifically, they were looking for that. And I think that's what they found, purportedly what they found in this tomb of Gilgamesh is this Stargate. And there was a story too of, I think Russian officers in like 91 saw the US shoot down a UFO in Iraq.
Interesting.
And yeah, so basically, yeah, it looks like that's possible. Stargate, UFO, whatever. I mean, there's this J-Rod story and the Stargate and all of that. So,
yeah, so in part 9, we might see a further investigation into the Stargate, because I find that absolutely fascinating. I have a very amateur level of knowledge here.
It just keeps getting crazier. So
we got part 9 to look forward to, and the documentary you're starting to work on for Magenta.
Definitely the documentary. Yeah, definitely some stuff about the death ray x-ray or death ray radar stuff. I don't know. I haven't really thought it out too much.
So Reddit and Medium under Voller Records, where else can people find
Medium,
you?
I started it about a year ago, losing my mind after Grush. And then my Reddit posts were getting too long. Oh, wait, I think I lost you. Where'd you go? Oh, sorry. What was I looking for? Oh, my medium is Escape Velocity.
Escape Velocity. Okay, I have that and your Reddit post in the video description.
Okay, so awesome. Cool.
I know that we kind of glossed over some of the details, but I highly recommend reading every single part 1 through 8 and clicking through the links, because in every single piece you've made, you have linked a tremendous amount of third-party research and other avenues to go down. And that is my favorite thing about this research, that nothing is just you saying, okay, here's an executive summary. It's the entire body of research with clickable links.
And people still complain, so whatever. I mean, I don't care anymore, but
you can never have 100%.
It's too many links, so whatever.
Hey, man, you know how many times I get people calling me out on my videos for not pronouncing words right? Yeah, there will always be some level of dissatisfaction. As long as you're putting together a cohesive thesis with supporting links and an argument, I think you're doing a fantastic job. And these 8 pieces I have learned so much from. I think they're amazing.
Cool. Yeah, I lost my mind. Trying to get it back now.
All right, Voller. Well, I will catch up with you privately, my man. And thank you so much for coming on the show. Once I wrap this up at here 6 p.m. my time, I'll shoot you a text and we'll talk a little more. Sounds all right. Good, thank you so much, brother. Yeah. I appreciate it. Man.
Of course.
All right. Bye, brother.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we're going to do 15 minutes of Q&A while I get Voller signed off here. Everybody, please thank Voller for coming on the show. He's done a tremendous 8 parts. It's incredibly difficult to try and talk about all 8 parts he's done, because this is like a massive body of research. So check out all 8 parts. We're going to do 15 minutes until I got to get off of Q&A, because you know I love to do that at the end. If you guys will give me 1 second, I'm just going to run to the restroom, put some questions up, and I will get to them in like 2 seconds. All right, give me less than a minute. I'll be right back. Okay, guys, I'm back. So let's start going through some questions. One of my boys texted me, said there was a little bit of quarrel going on in the chat. So if somebody wants to enlighten me as to what was going on, let me know. Also, I just find the connection of the entire Bush family to the legacy programs fascinating. And I think this is an avenue that should continue to be explored, and I cannot wait. So I did miss a couple super chats, Too Close, 2 Cents, Fat Rodents, Ort Wiener. Thank you guys so much for donating. I so appreciate it. I didn't get a chance to look at the chat during the conversation with Volar Records, but I appreciate him coming on the show so very much. I think those 8 pieces are fantastic. And I hope he makes a documentary on Magenta. Let's start with Big Dog. Yeah, the Bush research is fantastic, all the way from the Magenta crash to OSS to big oil companies and so forth. So we'll start going through these. Zach, what's up, brother? Where do you draw your line? Is open landing and contact on a military base too much? Fixed point out, it's like the same time and location as Socorro. I'm not sure, especially in terms of the Holloman and Edwards Air Force Base landing. It seems like a almost one-off occurrence as far as we know of Fox, not Fitz. Okay, I see. Fox points out it's like the same time and location as Socorro. I still find it strange, especially the Holloman Air Force Base landing is almost an isolated incident in which beings outright present themselves. However, there is one more story of that I'm going to cover up in my next video at an Air Force Base of some beings who almost willingly walk out of their craft and give it up. It's a story in one of Leonard Stringfield's crash retrievals. It's very interesting, so I can't wait to cover that. So let's see. Okay, you guys must be chatting about something in here. Let me know what you guys have been talking about. Have I watched the X-Files mythology episode? Highly recommend. No, but I've wanted to get into X-Files, especially a couple cool people in my Discord have been talking about X-Files and one of the creators, I think Frost, and how X-Files may have had a little bit of interesting inside tidbits in terms of this, in terms of their research. So what's your opinion on Daniel Salter and the Accio? I do not know what the Accio is. So if ACIO, I don't know if it's an acronym. So please fill me in so I can do some research. Have you had a chance to look at Larry Reed from Lockheed? You should try and get an interview with him. No, I have not. I still want to get, I'm still trying to get in, not contact, but a little more information on Dr. Jim Ryder as well. But Larry Reed is up there. Did I accidentally say cover up? I don't know. Did I? I don't think I did. I need to fix the spectacles. If I said cover up, let me know how I said it. The Iraq Gilgamesh and Bible and buried UAP rabbit hole. It's wild. I need to read the whole part eight because the Tomb of Gilgamesh in Iraq and a possible embassy being built in that region because of some sort of UAP technology or tech, as well as Dick Cheney, is really interesting. I'm such a novice here. That's why I was so excited when Voller texted me today and said that he had this part eight out on Stargate. It's wonderful. Mentioned of X-Files and Twin Peaks. I think the same Frost, the show writer, worked on both. Let's see. Everybody's loving Stargate is... Okay, let's see. It sounds like you and Voller need to get together with some of the connections you both talked about. I'm going to make him a chart of his names and dates and overlaps. You made him something. I'd love to see that. That's awesome. And I would love to work with Voller, Kermit, senior trader, 36, 39, 42, a lot of guys on kind of a joint project, because there are some amazing researchers out there that the bulk majority of their work has been put out on Reddit. And if I can help it, I'll use the platform to let some of them come on and talk about their research, like Voller. I think it's fantastic. Fringe is better than X-Files. I've never seen Fringe, so maybe I will have to watch that. So let's keep going through. Leave the Bill Herman abduction. Okay, maybe some new interesting abduction stuff coming up soon, guys. I've heard Stargate is a very good show, the original. I recently made an executive decision. I was between that and Battlestar Galactica, the early 2000s show. I decided to go with Battlestar, so maybe I'll do Stargate next. The first season of X-Files was based on real person's FBI case, John Souza. That sounds somewhat familiar, but my recollection is failing me, so I need to do some extra research there. Okay, I would love to team up with Jesse Michaels and Danny Jones. We'll see about Jesse. We never got to get together when he was here in Colorado. Just got to be a little bit too big, but he and I chat often, so there should be some more time soon coming up that we can link up. Sorry, Cheney must have met with analysts at CIA's WinPAC many times leading up to the invasion of Iraq. Probably. Yeah, absolutely. I still find it so interesting that according to Voller's research, Cheney may have had a vested interest in some exotic technologies at Iraq. Okay, let's see. After reading through Voller's posts and watching your vids, is there any area you recommend someone to look into? Something that is often overlooked? Patterns with bodies associated with crash retrievals. I think a lot of the time with crash retrievals, I talk about this a lot, people are afraid to go into the territory of bodies because it's so contentious, and a lot of people look at it with such ridicule, but it is, bodies are one of the most fascinating and kind of unexplored aspects of retrieval operations. Santiago, have I ever played Halo? Dude, is that even a question? Halo Reach is my ultimate gaming experience I've ever had. I know Halo 3 is probably considered the greatest Halo game, but I will continue to preach that Halo Reach was the pinnacle of gaming. I loved that game. Okay, so the ACIO, Advanced Contact Intelligence Organization. No, I need to look into that more. Is the Looking Glass located at S4? Yes, Mr. Mozilli. According to Dan Barish and a couple other alleged sources, Project Looking Glass is located at Area S4. According to the design specs by Dan Barish, S4 has five levels, with the lowest level housing J-Rod, level The level above being like a crew quarter for testing, the level above housing project Looking Glass. I get asked this all the time while I look into Dan Barisha, probably at some point, but I got a lot of other stuff first. The Looking Glass is pretty interesting. And there is a whole kind of PDF. It's like a book. It's called Project Aquarius that focuses on Dan Barisha's claims in Looking Glass. I highly recommend looking at that. I'll post a link to it in the Discord. I do remember Reach. Reach is fantastic. The final mission, Survive, is that can bring a tear to any man's eyes. Did you know the CIA trained psychic spies to build mental protective barriers around CIA facilities to prevent remote viewers from spying? Yes, I did. I've heard about that. I don't know specific instances, specifics, or specific individuals, but I have heard of that. And the CIA and private companies' research into psionics and psychic powers, remote viewing, is something that fascinates me greatly. Could reported classified alien religious documents be declared constitutional violation of freedom to practice religion by the Supreme Court, forcing disclosure? That is assuming that classified alien religious documents exist, which I think that is alleged by Bob Lazar and the Reddit biologist, I think, are the two people who have commented on that. If such documents exist, I think that would bring a lot of really interesting questions on theology. Can you please never say scintillating again? I'm sorry, I just did, but I'll try to. The word scintillating is great. So something or someone says, I wouldn't say remote viewing is real. I remain unconvinced. All I'm saying is rant. Okay, so you're talking about remote viewing. Yeah, I would also like to see demonstrations of remote viewing. Very interested in it. Have I come across a laboratory, Nazionale de Gran Sasso, in Italy in my research? I have never. But that might be something I'll pull over to Voller to look into in conjunction with the Magenta case. Scintillating. Okay. Guys, at this point, you know that there are many words that I pronounce absolutely horribly. In the videos, I go through and try to make sure I pronounce everything correctly, but I will miss stuff. I just can't speak too well. That being said, the new video should be here tomorrow or Tuesday. I'm thinking Tuesday to put some extra time into it. I really think you guys are going to enjoy this video. It is another primary investigation with a ton of research put into it. The video I would liken it most to is the Off-World Technologies Division. There are some pretty surprising research avenues here, so keep an eye out for that. I'm not going to spoil the name or the subject of it, and after that, we have another really cool crash retrieval. So fire away the questions, guys. We got a couple more minutes if anybody's got any more questions. And that maybe I'll give another hint to the next video. I mean, I guess I kind of disclosed something. It involves mention of various Air Force bases, such as Nellis. And that's going to be a cool one. Hey, I appreciate that, Hayden Pierce, even if I'm mispronouncing stuff. So this one involves the possibility of reverse engineering in various Air Force bases, most notably Nellis. There was a reason that I talked about the U-2 with Nellis and testing there, or at Area 51. Sorry, Area 51 is just northwest of Nellis at the Nevada Test and Training Range. Okay, so I think some in the comments, some of you guys are talking about not trusting Elizondo. What have been some of the arguments for and against Elizondo in the chat? If you guys are talking about Elizondo, I'd like to see some of these. So a little bit of discourse in the chat. You guys let me know what's going on. I appreciate that, big dog. There's so many topics in this space that aren't covered necessarily to a wide extent. And as we see with Voller Records work, research that even analyzing just a small case or an individual and their connection to UAP requires a tremendous amount of research and kind of diving into. You haven't checked the Scott Castle USO story. Guy says he has footage somewhere of a USO I'd be very interested to see that. I'd like to put some more time into USO research, especially with the implication of Woods Hole, Neuro, ONR, and so forth. So if there's any USO videos, I would like to see those. The only kind of USO related video I've seen was a Reddit post of just some anomalous lights under some water. This photo occurred at night. I'm sure you guys know what I'm talking about and have seen that. The guy says he has footage somewhere, a tale has as old as time. Yeah, a lot of with many cases there will be alleged footage. That's why stuff like Holloman and the Edwards Air Force Base is a bit frustrating, because even though somebody like Gordon Cooper, an accomplished Mercury astronaut, will say that footage exists, there's still no way to get our hands on such footage. Throughout Crash Retrievals Parts 1 through 7 from Leonard Stringfield, there is also much discussion of a supposed alien autopsy as well, some sort of lost footage. I think there was a NASA astronaut recently who mentioned seeing some sort of NHI video as well. Were you talking about the story where a guy from the retrieval team asks a bunch of languages, but the beans are just catatonic and walk right off the craft? Can I get the Stringfield PDF too? Yes, I will post that. And no, those are two different things. The bunch of languages is the infographics whistleblower who talks about the head doctor who is fluent in Russian, English, Chinese, and other languages. And he references some cases where the beans found are sort of like almost children that can be led by pointing. This is a small story. It's a small excerpt in Leonard Stringfield's, I think it's part 9 of Crash Retrievals Part 6. Sorry, there's a bunch of parts in it. And I only make mention of this because it is of important contextual relevance to my case. But yeah, I will tell you exactly where it is, Zach. Are you in the Discord? Because I'll post it there. Could there be a connection between UFO and the gremlins that the RAF, Royal Air Force, claimed would cause trouble for them? Quite possibly. I am not too familiar with the claims of RAF and the gremlins, so that might be something I have to look into a little bit. Space Geek says, thank you for all your hard work. You have the most well-researched videos. I truly believe once the YouTube algorithm finds you, you'll have millions of subs very soon. Thank you, ma'am. That'd be cool. I don't even know how to deal with 10,000 subs, let alone a million. But boy, that would be a dream. I'm going to post the Discord link one more time, guys, because Zach wants to hop in the Discord. If you want to chat about UAP during the day, talk about anything. There's some really sharp researchers in there too. Really sharp guys. Zach just posted. Anthony, good show. Interesting links about EG&G, Carlisle, and various players. Thank you. I very much appreciate that. Yeah, the story of Eric Tabor, especially with EG&G and Area 51, is really interesting, especially how it ties into the donation craft theory. That patch, there was a lot of controversy around that because I think Eric Tabor didn't think much about it initially, so he tried to pawn it off on eBay. That's why there was a bit of steam when Ross Coulthart posted the patch initially in his presentation, and then images surfaced of it up on eBay. So that got a little hairy at one point, but that's a great story. Of course, Eric Tabor is a second, if not a third hand whistleblower, but still him talking to Arrow is still of consequence. And I still find that extremely interesting and worth paying attention to. Okay, oh, you're talking about Roald Dahl. Okay, Roald Dahl talking about gremlins. No, that's interesting, but as a child, I loved Roald Dahl's work, especially the BIG. So I'd like to check that out. Okay, what are you guys? We'll answer a handful more, guys, and then we shall sign off so I can also post some of those documents and so forth in the Discord. If there's anything I forget to post, please just let me know. My mind's going like a couple miles or miles a minute when we talk, so there's some stuff I might forget, but I know I need to post for you, Zach, that specific excerpt of Crash Retrievals Part 1 through 7. I'll just post the full thing. And I'd love to talk a little bit about Michael Schratz diving into Leonard Stringfield's work. So that's another one I'd like to look into. But guys, if there are no more questions, okay. Oh, okay. Upcoming vids you are working on. Any tease? Yes. I just did tease the new video that should come out Monday or Tuesday. I will say one word, or I guess two words, and that is reverse engineering. And I guess another couple of words, I will say Air Force Base. And this video has been a blast to work on just as much as the Off-World Technologies Division. That's the sort of video I would liken it to. Big Dog, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate the support as always, man. And if you guys are arguing about Elizondo, Yuri Geller, how did he get brought up and other people do? I'd love to see it in the Discord or bring up the arguments. I'd love to see what you guys are talking about. But with that, my friends, we shall sign off for the day. And I really appreciate everybody joining. Thank you so much. The video should be out Monday or Tuesday. And we will have next stream on Sunday and possibly a couple other things coming out in between then. But thank you all so much for joining. And I will catch everybody on the next show.